Hello all, and welcome to the God Said Was podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an independent anarchist press that publishes socially engaged literature. We also do this, I do this podcast with the other two editors of XDB, and that is Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger. Today, we're going to talk about Jess Walter's The Cold Millions. And Chris, I'm going to hand it off to you, but I just wanted to say I'm super happy you picked this because finally, you know, during this podcast, all we have to do is just bitch about capitalism and, you know, talk about how we hate fucking bosses and we need to kill our bosses and how, you know, basically wage labor is a kind of slavery. So I wanted you to go first. You are the first person who gets to bitch about capitalism today. So just tell us how much you hate it.
I don't know that it's quite so easy as that. I mean, there is a kind of a representation of really, we can talk about what's his name?
I don't hear much bitching. I hear kind of like this hemming and hawing coming from you.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, we can talk about early Reston and like what he we'll get to it. Let's do a summary first. But like,
all right.
Yeah, that's fine. I don't think it's quite so simple as like as what you're saying. I think that it is definitely like really set at the height, and this is a historically more or less, you know, it has some decent fidelity actually occurred in Spokane in 1909, which was a climax of tension between the Wobblies, the IWW, and various large employers in Spokane, a huge boom town in Washington at the time. And we kind of come into the story with two brothers, Ryan and Gig. Gig is the older brother. He's for his upbringing, where he comes from, he's decently educated, charismatic, and invested in the Wobbly cause. Rye is 16. Gig is like 23 or something. Rye is a younger brother. He's just sort of, you know, tagging along. We mostly get this through Ryan. And they are in Spokane. They're what do you call them? Hobos? There's some distinction here. They make a distinction. They're working, but they're living in the streets, and they're hitching rides on trains. But they take part in what would you call it, Patrick? The Wobbly, the IWW, free speech.
It was like a rally, right?
It was a rally, yeah.
A free speech rally,
workers' rights rally, and they got rounded up and really terribly abused in prison or in jail. Ryan is eventually let out after a week because he's only 16, but Gig is in prison, and we follow Rye. He kind of tries to get his brother out, and he's doing this by engaging with the IWW, going around and telling a story. He's doing this by working with at least one of the rich sort of oppressive employers of Spokane. And I don't think that he's historically accurate. I think he's maybe an amalgamation that Jess created, Lem Brand. And he's along the way meeting all of these different people. It's very, I really enjoyed the book for how it sort of showcased this time and all of these characters of this time, kind of, almost a road trip, novel. We get to see different places, Taft, Montana is very interesting place, like kind of like the ninth ring of hell when it comes to like how little employers would care or invest in the health and well-being of their workers and what that leads to when you're out in the middle of nowhere in Montana. Spokane, Seattle, different places, different people in those places. And I think like one of the things that really interested me about it was Ryan as a protagonist, as a storyteller, in this, we get to see the story through different points of view, almost always occupying their point of view right before they die. I think that almost always,
a lot of them.
Yeah. The majority. And
who doesn't, Jules's niece,
Jules' niece, Ursula. Don't we stay in Ursula for?
Yeah, I think we see Ursula, and we see Elizabeth Gurley Flynn too.
Yes, yeah, but the rest of them die. Sully, Gig, Jules,
Del Devereaux,
who's one of my favorites. He was a real terrible person, but a great character.
He was a good character.
Yeah, great character, but. Kind of two things that sort of occur to me on a craft element, craft angle. Ryan does not have a lot of agency. And I think that that is kind of part of the story. Like even really at the end, he actually thinks about it he talks about it at one point in the novel where he feels like the only choice he's ever made is getting up on the soapbox to kind of take up the Wobbly cause. And even then it's not really like something that he does super intentionally. He does it, I think, for his brother. And even at the end, the climax, he's really not aware of what's going on around him. And I think that that's kind of interesting in this novel with so many people trying to kind of wrest agency either for the workers or away from the workers. And he is someone who is sort of, there's something honest about his naivete and lack of control over his own life and the lives of the people around him. I think there's a case to be made that the only person with agency is Early Reston with real agency. He's like a streak of darkness that runs through this book that like, I also find really interesting. And then I think that that's an interesting angle for me. Also the denouement I think is interesting because basically Ryan succeeds in getting his brother out, but his brother is not out enough to avoid getting involved in a final attack that's part of a that's taking place during a trial of taking place during the trial of these Wobblies and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. That the trial eventually kind of going enough in favor of the Wobblies to cement some progress on behalf of workers' rights and free speech in history, but not without this attack going awry, Gig dying, and then sort of going into the future 54 years, something like that, and sort of Ryan looking back on the subsequent years. And I find that last bit interesting. Or epilogue, not denouement. Did I miss anything, guys?
Um, trying to think. I feel like you hit all the major stuff.
Maybe too much. Maybe exhaustively. If so, I apologize.
No, it's all good. I mean, you mentioned that, like...
So you mentioned a few different angles of approach, Chris, to thinking about some of the... to thinking about questions about this novel. And you mentioned the character of Early Reston, and that... I'm a little curious as to your guys' reading regarding his function thematically, right? Because it was interesting to me to read this novel having covered Against the Day by Thomas Pynchon a couple months ago, right? Against the Day being something that is set, some of it is set in the same time period, some of it is set in maybe not the same location, but it also deals with the early union and workers' rights movements around the beginning of the 20th century and some of the violent conflicts that happened between the two, right? They're very different novels structurally, almost diametrically, right? Like, this is fundamentally a very clean novel. It's a very tidy novel in certain ways. If anything, maybe it was a little, for the most part, too clean and tidy for me, just on a personal aesthetic level, right? Relative to the kind of thing that I get attached to. I've said before on the podcast that if I finish something and I feel like I've pretty much got everything out of it that there is to get, I don't have a lot of lingering attachment to it, right? And Against the Day, it's interesting to compare this to Against the Day, where Against the Day is just this kind of enormous mass of characters and ideas and potentially self-contradictory things. And this is, in spite of having, I think, very much the same perspective, you know, morally, ethically, it has the same emotional relationship to what's being portrayed. It's pared down in a way that is the opposite of Against the Day. And I guess I say all that just to kind of set up, like, I found Early Reston interesting because he did seem like the, everything else here, I guess, it's like the maybe agenda is an unkind word, right? But like, there's a relationship that Walter has to the material and and to the historical time that it's very clear cut, right? There's not a lot of moral ambiguity. There's not any sense that, like, the heroes are very heroic and the villains are very villainous. And it's, you know, it is true that there are a couple places where that's muddied a little bit. Like, you know, the character of Del Delvo he's at least an interesting person for the little bit of time that we spend in his head. He's allowed to be a relatively fleshed out character in spite of being an agent of this industrialist who is a very, I think, unambiguously villainous person. But the Reston, I think, you know, he's, I guess I was wondering what you guys saw as being his relationship to the class conflict that's at the center of the novel and what he says thematically either about that class conflict or about how, like, what the appropriate means are of trying to bring about change.
It's you. So you brought up Against the Day. I thought of Webb Travers, you know, like with Early Reston. We meet it near the end, someone that Early Reston has worked with in the past. I think his name is Miller, and he's a dynamite guy. And both Early Reston and Miller, early more so because he's a real chameleon. He's someone who's capable of murdering a person at lunch at a cafe and getting away with it. In a kind of like a, he reminded me of almost like one of those sort of Billy Bob Thornton plays a character like this in the first season of the Fargo series, but one of those monsters in a Coen Brothers film who's just sort of weirdly capable of killing people and just sort of getting away with it in a way that almost seems almost like magical realism. Like, it just doesn't make sense that he's this deadly and smart and mysterious and kind of, you know, kind of an enigma, a sociopath, you know, and I think there's a kind of a trick where you make a sociopathic murderer enigmatic and strange, and that sort of is it creates that sense of like depthlessness in them that like makes them scarier, because you realize you really can never really understand their motivations or why they're doing what they're doing. And that's something that early Rustin has. But you mentioned Against the Day and you know, like the characters in Against the Day that are sort of, you know, blowing things up, that are trying to monkey wrench. I guess they're not really trying to kill anybody, but they don't have, I can't think of any of the anarchists represented in the way that early Rustin is, if early Rustin is an anarchist, because, you know, like, I don't know that we ever really get a clear answer as to what motivates him. He could just be a murderer who's using the conflict of the time to, you know, give structure to his crimes. I don't know. Patrick, what did you think?
Yeah, this is definitely a very, like, this was probably the big question for me revolves around Rustin's character, because, you know, someone, I forget which character, one character refers to him just as an opportunist, and I think this is how I prefer to think of him, just because if the book doesn't take him as an opportunist, if the book takes him as a genuine anarchist, then it's making a much larger, bigger claim about how what resistance should look like. And, you know, if he's just an opportunist, you know, then he's just an opportunist. He's just like a crazy, like, you mentioned a Coen Brothers film, like he's just like an Anton Chigurh,
yeah,
from you know, which is originally a Cormac McCarthy novel, No Country for Old Men. Great novel, by the way, guys. and a good movie adaptation. You know, if he's just an opportunist, then he's kind of this like Anton Chigurh character. But if the book takes him as an anarchist, then it would seem that the book kind of shies away from using violence as a means of resistance. So that was a big thematic question for me. But comparing this to Against the Day, I find it interesting because all the anarchists are in Against the Day, while they may use violence, they don't seem like depthlessly evil like no. Rustin does, you know? And so I don't know. What do you guys think about that? I don't know.
It's interesting to think about the Against the Day comparison further, because one thing that bothered a lot of people about Against the Day, and I think we talked about this to some extent, but one thing that bothered a lot of people about Against the Day is that it does not seem adequately opposed to the idea of violence as a form of political resistance, right? It struck a lot of people as seeming relatively comfortable with it. And there are scenes toward the end that maybe are, that complicate that a bit, right? There's a scene where one of the Traverse brothers is involved in he's a victim of an anarchist bombing, and it is portrayed in this very heartrending, unpleasant way. But Against the Day doesn't go out of its way to say, hey, you know, actually, I, Thomas Pynchon, think that violence is not an appropriate form of resistance in most contexts, right? Like, it's there's a level of, I think, clarity that a lot of people wanted from it in terms of its stance on the use of violence as political resistance that it was not actually willing to offer. And that even made me a little bit queasy, right?
Like, really? Because I'm actually happy with that. I'm actually happy that...
Well, it made me ethically queasy, but I admired it artistically, right? I thought that was much more interesting and much more effective than if it had been more clear in the stance that it took, right? So when I say that it made me queasy, I mean queasy in a good way, in an aesthetically good way, right? But the interesting thing about it is that, like, it Cold Millions, it seems to me, and maybe I'm oversimplifying or reading too much into it, I think that I don't think that that same ambiguity is built into Cold Millions, right? Like, the fact that the one character who really employs violence as a political end is, I think, basically made out to be a sociopathic opportunist and not someone with any real ideological underpinning. It kind of takes... It removes a lot of what could be... It oversimplifies some of what could be a more thematically troubled approach, right? I mean, talking about, like, you guys made the comparison to Anton Chigurh. He reminded me a bit of, you know, like, and I don't want to get too much into contemporary politics, but, like, the guy who loots a Target because all the cops are off tear gassing the protest, right? Like,
right.
Where, yeah. I mean, one thing that I heard a lot in the media that I was consuming over last summer was, like, okay, like, most of the people who are doing violent things in the context of protests in American cities are doing it because there's chaos and it's fun to, you know, there's an opportunity for chaos because the normal order is being destabilized or upset, not because they see looting a Target as being a way of achieving a social justice end or, you know, toppling the bourgeoisie or anything like that, right? And it seems like, even though you could, if you wanted, you could read a little bit of ambiguity into it, but it really seems like Reston is basically made out to me, it seems like he's essentially made out to be a Target looter who's feeding on chaos and not someone who has admirable political ends, and that avoids some mess that could otherwise be interesting if troubling, right?
Well, no, I totally agree that the book does not... Like, the book sees Reston as, like, the book is definitely, like, Reston as a sociopathic killer. He's mostly here to use this struggle for his own gain. And, but I also wonder if the book takes that next step and says, violence is not acceptable as a form of resistance. And that is a question that I still have.
I don't, like, know.
The problem for me is, in making him a sociopathic killer, he stops being an analog of actual anarchists, is the problem. Like, actual anarchists... And at the turn of the century, we're okay with using violence and political assassinations and all that, but they're not sociopaths. They don't kill for opportunistic reasons. They do it because they're resisting greater violence. And I really feel like I need to bring that up because, you know, you're talking about the Black Lives Matter protests and all that. And you know, the greatest amount of violence was done by police in that, you know, the police did a ton more violence than any protester did. So I really just want to understand if the book equates anarchism with sociopathic violence or not. That's a big question for me.
I don't think that it's addressing it. I think that that's part of, like, Like, so it's not really interested in addressing that question.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So like, it's not about anarchism really. And I don't think that it is even really about socialism, I think that it is really very narrowly about a workers' rights conflict. And then sort of following my kind of when I mentioned Ryan's lack of agency, I think that I don't think it's interesting in answering the question as to whether anarchists are or are not sociopaths. You know, I think that you and I, Patrick, have different feelings about like the responsibilities of fiction to, you know, to the representation of movements like anarchism and any movement whatsoever, does it need to, is it beholden on, like, if Early Reston is an opportunist, is the book saying that all anarchists are opportunistic killers?
That was just a question I had. Yeah. I don't know that it is.
Yeah. I don't think that it's very interested in that, because I think that it's really actually more interested in examining this conflict kind of like almost like depth of field, everything around all the larger movement and all the larger movements around Ryan are sort of out of focus. Like, I think the clearest we get is, you know, like through Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, some representation of real sort of values that underpin values and goals that are sort of guiding some of the larger forces that are sort of, you know, trying to define like how society functions and, you know, rights for women, rights for workers. I think that one of the things that, you know, sort of for me, like maybe sort of sheds a light on this is like Ryan's kind of sort of spectator passenger quality that, like, you know, we are getting this clear picture of this one year really, and this place and time in which all of these, like, all of these larger forces came to bear, but it's not really about those forces. I don't know if I'm making sense. That was not really my sense. And I kind of felt like, you know, I kind of wonder, like, did you guys feel that like this was saying that, you know, I think it was clearly saying that like these rich employers, this sort of Spokane aristocracy was oppressing the common person and definitely was committing evil.
You could say it.
You could say evil.
You could say these fucking pig sucker capitalist pieces of shit are evil. You can say that.
I don't like saying that. I don't. One of the things that I am not really. That's not really in my character, man. So it's not really something that I ever want to say. But the
All right.
Yeah, but the they. I don't know that like the book really shows that progress is something that like any of these forces, you know, like none of these forces really like the Wobblies are only temporarily successful, and then, you know, looking back in the subsequent years, we see this big mess of different movements and eventualities and progress and loss of progress. And I don't know, I guess I didn't see anything clean about like any of it. Sorry, I'm not being very clear, guys.
I thought Flynn, the character of Gurley Flynn, she seemed pretty unambiguously heroic. Maybe I'm wrong about that. The way that she was portrayed, I guess, Chris, I mean, you said you didn't see anything clear about it. It seemed to me like the heroes and the villains were pretty clearly defined, right? I mean, the fact that this particular struggle did not permanently change the relationship of capital and labor in the United States doesn't necessarily mean that Walter doesn't have a clear position on it that the book is unambiguous about.
Right, right,
and
right.
I mean, I think the coda is very important too, because maybe I'm oversimplifying this, but my sense is that the subtext of that coda is that Ryan did in fact go on to have a prosperous middle-class life because of, he was in a union metalwork job,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, for him, I mean, and maybe I'm collapsing some things that are more complex in the novel, right? But you have the rise of unions at the beginning of the 20th century. You have this man's entire life being spent in, you know, middle-class comfort, right? And a comfortable retirement, and he provides for his family. And I mean, obviously there are things like World War II that cause him heartache, right? But like the underpinning of his life is provided by his union job. And now we in 2020 understand that system, that comfort did not last, right? That the gains that were made in that time have eroded and eroded and eroded since then, and unions
right.
are back in, we're back at a point of being, we're back now at a point of severe economic inequality, and labor unions are in not in a good spot in terms mm-hmm. of cultural or economic power. And I think Walter understands that he doesn't need to say all that, right? Like any reader that cares enough about these themes to get where he's taking things up to the 60s is going to be able to understand why
right.
2020 is not 1961, right? But I mean, I do think that I don't think there's any doubt that it's a pro-union novel, right? And the closer that somebody is to labor union organizing, the more unambiguously virtuous they are as a character. The further they are from that, the more unambiguously evil they are. Reston is in sort of an in-between point, and he's an ambiguous character, right? But I mean, it's in some ways, I do think that, you know, I was going to say that in some ways it's more a character-driven novel than it is it's more driven by character than it is by its sympathy for labor unions. But I suppose it does strike a pretty good balance there, right? I mean, it is very character-driven. It is, honestly, I mean, I could, for the most part, overall, I could kind of take or leave this novel as a novel, right? I mean, certainly its heart is in the right place, but I was not as touched by it or as moved by it or as engaged by it as I think you guys were. To the extent that I was, and I was more so in the second half than the first half, to the extent that I was more taken in with it in the second half, it did have to do with, I think, Ryan really becoming he's not necessarily a complex character, but he's a simple character who's sketched with enough depth and consideration and heart that he becomes appealing in spite of his kind of uncomplexity, right? In spite of his simplicity. And I think that jump forward to the 60s was very smart. I really appreciated that. I appreciated that because there's something about that that, like, understanding that the characters in this book were still alive when my parents were in elementary school really kind of makes it seem, even though that's maybe not a rational response, it made everything in the book seem a bit more like it was happening in my world in some way, you know? Mm-hmm. And I appreciated that little touch. And there was just something emotionally affecting about seeing the arc of that character's life. And I found that more effective than... In the first half of the novel, I thought that, you know, the political sympathies of it and the kind of... Even though I agree with the political sympathies of it, I didn't necessarily find them that interesting in a novel, right? And I have this personal hang-up around historical fiction where, like, the more you can tell that the author did research, the more distanced I feel from the writing.
That's hilarious.
And, like, the first 40 or 50 pages of this novel, the first 40 or 50 pages are just, like, this barrage of, like, hey, look, I spent a bunch of time in the archives in the Spokane Library. Look at everything I know about this period, you know? Like, if you imagine, like, I just always think about, I read something like this and I think about, I don't know, like The Great Gatsby, right? Imagine, like, the difference between reading The Great Gatsby and reading a novel that was written now by someone trying to occupy the perspective of a person living during the Roaring Twenties, right? The Great Gatsby does not feel the need to go to great length to situate you in that world. And yet it does, in fact, situate you in that world because it's written by someone in that world. And a lot of novels that are written 100 years after the fact of their action, it's like there's something about like the way that the characters are always noticing and thinking things that situate you in their world makes the characters to me seem very cardboard, right? The fact that Rye and Gig are always noticing things that, you know, Jess Walter saw in an archive somewhere made it much harder for me to bond
we get
with
it.
Them as a
you
reader.
Fucking hated yeah. this book. We yeah. get it.
The thing is, like, I understand that most people find that kind of thing really interesting. I understand that I understand that this is a pet peeve and not a legitimate aesthetic critique.
No, I think it is legitimate.
No, it is.
Yeah,
I think it is
totally
too,
legitimate.
Actually.
I think it's an interesting, like, just returning to Against the Day, like you mentioned. Like the clear villains and good guys of the Cold Millions, but like, you know, Against the Day has Scarsdale vibe, you know, and then like Against the Day is very, very researched. Like even if it like doesn't, you know, cleave very faithfully. In fact it takes glee in just sort of like playing with historical what actually happened. But I'm curious, like when you look, so I kind of want to push on what you were describing as like the non-messiness of the Cold Millions versus the messiness of Against the Day, because it feels like it's not that the Cold Millions has Lem Brand, because Against the Day has Scarsdale vibe, and it's not that the Cold Millions is researched, because Against the Day is research. So I'm curious, like what, like, I think it's a legitimate avenue for criticism, because the Cold Millions feels very crafted. Like it feels, you mentioned character driven. It feels really plot, like very, like it's plotted really well. It has forward momentum, like in the way that this could be made into a film. It's clean in a plot way, where the climax is just like really, I don't know, it feels like something that, you know, could be written in a screenplay, like I said, and it would make sense. And maybe, is that what you mean by like the non-messiness of it?
That's part of it, yeah. And this is an aside, but one thing that, again, like I understand that this is individual and not, you know, I don't expect anybody to agree with this, but a lot of the dialogue and the observation in Cold mm-hmm. Millions, it actually did strike me as very filmic, right? It's like screenplay writing, where every time somebody says something, they give you a little bit of information and they have a quip, right? Everything is an informative quip. And it has that kind of economy about it where everything's got to be a little bit entertaining and a little bit witty, but it's also got to be there for, you know, informational purposes or to tell you how that character thinks. And I think of that as being, and I don't know that I can say much more than that to really kind of capture the feel of it, right? But there's something about that that I think of as, it's like good enough TV writing, right? Like all the dialogue felt like good enough TV dialogue writing. And a lot of the observations the characters made had that same quality where they had to have a little bit of observational wittiness to them. They had to be a little bit cute. Even though, like, it wasn't really ever, like, funny in a way that I found pleasing, right? And I mean, to some extent, I'm dodging here from the reasonable point that you're making about my hypocrisy and really liking Against the Day and criticizing some of the same things in The Cold Millions, right? I think part of, I mean, just to touch on the two things, the part of Against the Day that involved, like, capitalists are pigs, yay unions, oh, fight the power, like that aspect of it was probably the thing that I found the least interesting. Again, just because, like, I'm not that, you know, like, if I want somebody to say, fuck capitalists, fight the power, you know, I've got Vox.com for that, you know, or whatever. Like, it's not something that I seek out in a novel, and it's not something I find that interesting in a novel, right? So, I mean, to the extent that Scarsdale Vibe is an unambiguous cartoon villain, you know, if I were to list all the thing, of all the qualities of Against the Day, that's one of the qualities that I found less interesting. I think the research aspect of it, to some extent, I didn't mind that so much because, like, the stuff that is research, a lot of it was either, like, so much of the real historical detail is subsumed in weird literary affectations or weird nonsense conspiracy theories or stuff about the center of the earth. I mean, there's just so much in Against the Day, and so much of it is strange and weird, and you're not sure why it's there. Or it's written with, honestly, just a much, much greater level of legitimate humor and skill, I think, than most of The Cold Millions. And I say that really respecting the craft of Cold Millions, right? It is very well crafted, but there's, when Pynchon's really firing on all cylinders, there's a level of just, like, surreal skill that he can pull off that I don't think Walter's really trying for, right? And mm-hmm. I think by, like, most contemporary aesthetic values, it's better to exercise the kind of restraint and discipline that Walter does here at the expense of making yourself look like a crazy genius who can pull off brilliant sentences, right? Like, most critics, most writing teachers would say that, like, the restraint and focus of this novel relative to Against the Day is a virtue, right? But
the restraint is a virtue, but I agree that Pynchon is certainly better on a sentence level, 100%.
And I think some of the stuff that's bothering me about Cold Millions is, honestly, just I can forgive it in Pynchon because it is better at a sentence level, or it is just, you know, like, one thing that stuck out, I keep thinking about, there's a line in Against the Day where there's a reference to, they make a cradle for the baby out of a dynamite crate, right? Because dynamite crates aren't made with nails, because nails might create a spark and set off the dynamite. I love that, right? And mm-hmm. as I was reading this and being annoyed, as I was reading Cold Millions and being annoyed by the, like, look at me, I did the research stuff, I would sometimes think, like, what if he put in that line about the dynamite crate from Against the Day? Would that annoy me here because I have this, for whatever reason, bias against this novel and bias in favor of Pynchon? Or is that just objectively a better research detail? I don't know. I don't have a good answer. And I think that a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about, I kind of forgave in the second half of Cold Millions as I eventually got more into the character. But, you know.
What did you think of the little interpolated stories? You know, like we get the guy who gets who dies going over the waterfall. We learn that that was Jules, who
saw that,
whose barge he stole, who saw it happen. Dale Dalvo, Dale Dalvo. That's how you say his name.
I think I said Devereaux when I first said it, but I think it's Dalvo.
Because
or Waterbury, like the first narrator is one of those interpolations, right?
The narrator
at the beginning of the novel is a cop who gets shot and bleeds out.
We're right in interpreting that as an early Reston murder, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's made pretty clear.
Yeah.
But, I think about this mostly with the guy going over the waterfall and maybe especially Dell, because I could feel like almost like a different novel bursting out of Dell, almost like it was packed in there, but he could, I think it's one of those things where like this, it is very economical. You use that word, Hans, and because everything is serving a purpose, you know, really to propel the plot forward, you know, and to make sure that the characters end up where they need to end up when they need to end up there, and everything is in alignment, and there's a tidiness to it. And then there's Dell in the middle, and it's kind of a long chunk, you know, and we really don't need it. Like if you think about it, like I kind of wonder if that's sort of like,
and we don't need the 1800s one either, where Jules watches the cowboy go over the waterfall. We don't need that one.
Yeah, and I actually really liked those, and I kind of wonder if that's like those feel like.
I before you Unbounded. Go on, Hans, I just wanted to say, Chris, that I really enjoyed these little interpolated stories. I thought they were one of the most successful aspects of the novel.
Me too. And I wonder if like that's kind of this thing where like, you know, you have the plot of the novel, you have like these like seams, like you have the historical fidelity. And then you have which actually is kind of like the kind of historical world building. That's like a reason that people read these. Like people will like people want paragraphs and paragraphs about the freaking clothes that they're wearing and stuff, you know, and you know, and that's fine. But like, I kind of share your boredom with that, Hans. And that being one sort of like structural element in this, and then the other structural element being like the plotting, and then you have these little interpolated stories where it's like, well, I know where this is ending, so I get he's gonna die, so I get to, and all I need is for him to end up in that cafe with Early Reston, and so let me spend like 30 pages getting there. I think maybe a little bit shorter than that, but like and then it's fun, you know, it's kind of like this loop-de-loop that we get to run with Dell, who's a little monster and is fascinating though. I was actually legitimately shocked when he died, because I was like, oh man, this is the best character you've had so far, you know? And like, I don't know. Does that, because what I mean is, like, I think your criticism is valid, Hans. I think that it's valid because you could actually show within this novel how much more life there could be if you just sort of, like, it's like, you know what? Fuck, this is actually not about Ryan. This is about Dell. Mm. Like, you know,
I see
or
what
like,
you're saying.
I don't know, that it's kind of a workshoppy,
like if he let it explode response. in the same way that Pynchon lets Against the Day explode.
Yeah.
Do you know what that effect reminded me of a little bit, actually? If you guys remember, I'm going to butcher the title, maybe, A Brief History of Seven Killings.
Yeah, I definitely thought of there's, that novel.
In particular, as I recall, toward maybe like the third quarter of Brief History of Seven Killings, there's a section that we spend in the POV of a gay hitman in New York.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great, right? And I think like we all said, oh, this is one of the best parts of the novel. And then we found later on that he had started writing from there. Yeah, and the Del Delvaux bit reminded me of that, right? It reminded me of that effect. And even like my feelings in reading that section of Brief History and you know, eventually discovering that we did not get to stay with that character for very long, and he does not get to live in that world for very long, right? And I'm beyond, you know, making that connection. I do agree with you guys that those were pretty effective for the most part. And I mean, even though to some extent, like the first couple pages, I tended to like this novel least when it was setting things up, right? So like the first couple pages where it's like you learn about that character's feelings about the world as expressed in sort of a pithy, you know, quotable little epigram that is about like good TV level writing, right? And then you get some historical detail. It always like takes a minute to like get the engine started with that kind of shit. But then once we spend a little bit of time in that character's POV, it is interesting. And I think having that break from Rye's viewpoint is really helpful, right? Like even though I said earlier that I liked the, oh, in the long term, like connecting with Rye did make the novel more approachable for me by the end. I think it's also true that only having his perspective might get limiting and cloying if it were the only thing you had for 300 pages. So I think it was wise to have those multiple shifts, and it was, and they are, for the most part, I agree, well handled.
Would you call this literary, Hans? Or is that an annoying question? I think that's a fair response if that's an annoying question.
But we had a whole like 2-hour conversation, and there's no way to like define it.
That being said, though, I mean, I think that it strives to be literary. I think it very self-consciously strives to be literary in the sense that I think it, I don't remember now any of the definitions that we came up with, but it, so there's a quote.
Mine was the best, probably.
Probably, yeah. There's a quote, and a bunch of different people have said it different ways, but I remember, I think this came up, Patrick, when you and I were talking to the author of The Sodomites. And
Adi Kalai?
And one thing that Adi Kalai mentioned was the value of fiction as a means of exploring different perspectives, right? Mm-hmm. That written fiction, there's a way in which you can get into the thought process of different people and contrast those perspectives and thought processes in the medium of written fiction that you can't really in any other medium, and that remains a unique virtue of the novel. There's a Richard Powers quote about that that was kind of a guiding light of mine in grad school, even though I don't really like any of Richard Powers' actual work, right? So
that's interesting.
And in some ways, I mean, I think that the
thanks, no thanks,
the
Richard
Cold
Powers.
Millions. Right. I hope Richard Powers doesn't listen to this podcast or
Jess Walters for that matter.
Fans.
Let's hope Jess doesn't listen
or Jess
to
Walters
them.
For that matter. but I mean, I think that, you know, that technique of trying to use fiction to map out sympathetically the perspectives of different characters and to contrast those in ways that is thought-provoking. I mean, I think that that's one thing that I think the use of that technique is one thing that defines fiction as literary in its aspirations, right? And, you know, that's very much used here. In some ways, I don't know. Like, Brand, you know, it's telling that Brand is the one person, if I remember right, whose perspective we never actually occupy, right? Mm. And I don't think
early,
that
we never get early either. But, yeah.
Oh, that's true. We don't. We don't. But I mean, it's not like I want the novel to like even-handedly make the case for Lemuel Brand's perspective, right? But like, there are ways, I suppose, that you could have used this more provocative. You could have used that more provocatively or in a more challenging way. But that's just an aside, though. I mean, I do think that it aspires to be literary, and my case for that would be that it's very conscious of trying to sympathetically stake out the viewpoints of as many people as possible. And I think that, that's one benefit of that. That's one benefit of those interpolations that we've been talking
about. Yeah, especially the Dow one, where like beforehand you're like, I don't like this guy. But during it, you're like, oh, geez, he's getting killed. I feel kind of bad for him.
Same thing with the police, too, actually, right? I mean, like, it, even though, you know, the police chief at the end is kind of...
Oh, yeah, yeah,
sort of
Sullivan.
One-dimensional idiot, right? Sullivan, yeah. But, I mean, he actually manages to be in his role as a one-dimensional, you know, self-justifying doofus.
Right.
He does still manage to be likable, surprisingly.
Right, exactly.
And actually, I suppose there's a little bit of daring involved in making your corrupt right-wing police chief a likable fellow that you're kind of getting to enjoy his viewpoint right before he gets shot. There's some daring there, I suppose, or at least some, you know, if a 25-year-old wrote this novel, I feel like it would not be as sympathetic to the corrupt police chief, and I do appreciate that.
But that sympathy, isn't there kind of almost a formula for that sympathy? I think about, like, who's Lem Brand's guy, the Pinkerton who works for him?
Early Reston?
No. We don't even know that.
Oh, Willard?
Actually, is Willard.
Willard,
yeah.
Yeah.
Willard comes forward, and he's like an upstanding dude in the end, right? He's like, you know, Lem doesn't even know I'm here. He's, you know, there's that perfect, like, perfect, almost kind of, I think it's like probably the line, Hans, that like, that was like where you can't decide whether you want to tell this book to screw itself or admire it, where Willard reminds Ryan of his, you know, his lack of peripheral vision as a way of hinting that Ryan should take, as a pithy way of hinting that Ryan should take the money. And it's like a perfect ending to that scene, in a kind of a filmic way. It's a film line. It's a really good film line. But Willard and Chester, the tailor who, you know, helps, I think his name is Chester, helps Ryan out. Isn't there kind of a formula for like saying, ooh, this is right when someone who you wouldn't expect who occupies a strata of society that doesn't normally produce this type of person, I'm just going to throw this little zag in here, this little crazy Ivan, to kind of remind readers and remind the protagonist of the depths of human kindness. Isn't there kind of a little bit of a shallowness to that if you like turn it on its side?
Well, it's definitely a technique.
It's a technique.
It goes back to Dickens, right?
Yeah, it's
like
totally
when
Dickens.
I read Dickens, maybe it goes before Dickens, but Dickens perfected it, I think. I mean, I remember when I read, the last time I read Great Expectations, it struck me that, like, the whole book is just this cycle of, here's a character, they seem grotesque and horrifying, you don't like them. Then, oh, it turns out they're actually a decent, well-rounded human being, and they become friends with Pip, and they're sympathetic. And, whoop, now here's another horrifying grotesque. And I admire that, right, in the context of, in the way that Dickens uses it, I think is good. And, I mean, I don't know, just, I think that, like, there are, man, like, I don't mind the use of it, even when it does seem a bit formulaic. I mean, of all the tropes in the world, it's probably one of the tropes that I'm more sympathetic to. Hence, I suppose, my sympathy to it here. But sure, you're right that it can be trope-ish, formulaic.
That was my last attempt to turn you against the novel, Hans. But it seems that your love of it is too strong.
Yep.
So anyway,
Hans, you're probably wondering what my pick is for next week.
Yeah.
So my pick for next week, you longtime listeners to the show will probably have noted that a lot of my picks tend to fall into one of two buckets, right? Either it's like, here's this depressing new social realist novel about how we live now, or here's this puzzle box novel I don't get. Can you guys help me crack it, right?
Right.
And I was going to pick a depressing social realist How We Live Now novel.
Yeah,
but
do
God,
that.
It's just such a beautiful day, and I'm so tired of being bummed out all the time.
Oh, fair enough.
So I'm actually going to say a puzzle box novel that I read several years ago, really enjoyed, but I couldn't begin to tell you the first thing about what it means, which is The New York Trilogy by Paul Auster.
The New York
Technically
trilogy.
Three novellas, but they're all quite short, and they're generally published, read, and discussed as one unit. So, New York Trilogy by Paul Auster.
I feel like I've heard of Paul Auster, but I'm not sure.
I've read three Paul Auster novels, and the first two were fantastic. This is one of the first two, and then the third was so bad that I'm wondering now if maybe the first two weren't as good as I thought. So.
All right.
I remember now about the third one is the protagonist has a girlfriend who doesn't want to get pregnant, and she tells him, put it in the funny hole, not the baby hole. Those are her exact words. And when I got to that line, I was just like, I can't do this, Paul Auster.
Which one's the funny hole? There are so many holes.
She means her butt.
Yeah. I mean, I'm intelligent enough to have gotten that. You know,
sorry, didn't mean to insult your intelligence, but yeah, New York Trilogy, Paul Auster.
You did insult me, but I'm correcting you. It's okay. The New York Trilogy by Paul Auster, listeners. That's what we are going to listen or talk about next time. Pretty good discussion on The Cold Millions. Chris and I seem to have enjoyed it. And Hans's response was a little more ambiguous. That being said, it was a pretty interesting novel. So I hope you guys enjoyed us talking about it. And until next time, comrades, peace out.